Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And my guest, once again, is the famous, sometimes infamous, Bradley Coates, lawyer extraordinaire. Divorce with Decency is his book, now in its fourth edition, coming up on five editions. Bradley, how are you?
I'm good. And I am busy trying to get this fifth edition together. It's got to go to the publisher by next week. So I'm scrambling, but I'm never too busy to take time to talk to Diana. So,
well,
fire away.
I appreciate that very much. We go back, Brad and I go back to 1999 when the first edition of Divorce with Decency, the complete how-to handbook and survivor's guide to the legal, emotional, economic, and social issues. First edition published in 1999, and you came on my radio show then in Honolulu. And our friendship is still going strong. I'm very grateful for that. And you're always just a wonderful guest. This is probably, on this program, probably your fifth or sixth appearance, maybe more.
Hopefully not my last.
Okay, good. Good. And you were my most frequent guest when I had the show in Hawaii. So Brad and I get along just fine. And we're going to talk about life after divorce. And this is his chapter 8 in the fourth edition of the book, romantic relationships in this modern millennium, and the pros and cons of marriage versus singlehood, cohabitation. This is a very readable book, and you're going to get a lot of really good information in this book, and they can find it on Amazon.
That they can, or if they can find a bookstore anywhere.
Bookstore,
if bookstores still exist.
Oh, they do, yes. I prefer bookstores, but then again, I'm an older person.
I'm older too, and I absolutely hate to see the demise of the bookstore. It just it was such a nice sort of centralizing aspect for civilization. I hate to see him go. But more power to Amazon, I guess, if it's going to conquer the world. But
well, Barnes
I'd love
and Noble
to be able to just
locally
go through racks
here,
of books
and
Borders,
I think you have
personally.
A Barnes and Noble in Hawaii as well. They're still going.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think
good.
They're one of the last ones left standing here in this town.
Yes.
Local bookstores. There's a couple local bookstores, but
yeah.
I miss Borders, frankly.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your Divorce with Decency 5th edition, what will be some of the add-ons for the 5th edition?
Well, that's what I thought it might be interesting to talk about today, Diana. You know, when you talk about, you know, where romantic relationships are going in this new millennium, the single biggest thing that is happening is that people are not getting married anymore with anywhere near the regularity that they used to, certainly when you and I were growing, when our parents were spawning us, or when, you know, yeah, where everybody was married when our parents were, and then a lot of us were married young or multiple times, you know, at our, you know, you and I are both in our 60s. I don't want to pin you down, but I'm somewhere in that zone. And I
don't care that much. Anyway, go on.
The reality of it is that, you know, we all used to get married and think that was the deal. And nowadays, you know, these younger kids, the new millennium Gen X types, are just they're not getting married with anywhere near the rate that we did. They're all postponing marriage until way, way later. And then if they do get married at all, and what's really happening is that there a lot of people are just not getting married, period. They're opting for cohabitation, and the number of unmarried couples living together without wedlock is up about tenfold since 1960, and about 40% of all the kids being born in the U.S. nowadays are born out of wedlock, and maybe as many as half of all the kids for women under 30. So it's really a major, major change where you get these people living together without getting married. They're still having sex, which is probably good news for you as a sex therapist. So they're having kids, But what's that doing is that, you know, about 40% of these unmarried couples have brought kids into their relationship. So you start combining all those statistics, and what you've got in the family court system is this huge increase in the paternity calendar, what's called the paternity calendar. That's a special calendar that courts utilize for when people are getting or having children out of wedlock. I mean, you're not really dividing up property, but you still have to divide up custody and child support and those kinds of issues. So that's called the paternity calendar, and that the growth on that calendar is just exploding. Meanwhile, the growth or the lack of growth on the divorce calendar is becoming a bit surprising too. There's been a huge drop off in the number of people getting married just in the last decade, starting in about 2005 and continuing on to whereby, you know, 2010, 2011, you know, the statistics are just being compiled for a lot of this, but, you know, as much as marriage rates were dropping off by as much as 5% a year, some experts think, that's a major, major change in society.
Of course it is. Let's back up a little bit, because your Chapter 8, the Life After Divorce, starts with the Gray divorce. And,
right.
And so... Gray is in quotes, but it's people who've been married a long time, and relationship boredom sets in. So I know about that. I see these couples all the time, and you see them in your office, and you see that they're like you quote or you allude to Arnold and Maria. And also the Gore's marriage. These are long-time marriages that ended up in divorce.
Yep, and that seems to be what happens. People are living so darn long nowadays, and the expectation is that everybody's got to be perfect through every stage of their life, you know, have a perfect mate through every stage of life, and it just gets harder and harder to meet. And so the rate of divorce is going up for gray marriages, and again, these are people who've been married, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, and are people in their 60s now, or 70s even, and all of a sudden, these most intact marriages the ones that we assume to be the most intact are all of a sudden splitting, and you know, Al Gore and Tipper Gore break up. I mean, you just don't expect to see that. You expect to see Donald Trump recycle a new wife every 10 years, but you just don't expect a boring old guy like Al Gore to suddenly be breaking up with Tipper. So it is it's just a different situation that is sort of, you know, having some spiraling effects on society as we know it. The gray divorces are probably not spawning a second set of kids. So it's really just a situation where they're dealing with you know, the standard procedures of splitting up property and pension and houses and stuff in divorce court. Probably the kids are even grown by then, so you really haven't got the child custody issues. But what I'm more focused on in this new edition of the book is this new generation that doesn't get married, so they don't have, I mean, say what you will about marriage, but it was a sort of a social structure that sort of rein people in a little bit and cause them to behave in a way that was, you know, more, well, you know, it sounds crazy to say socially acceptable, because it's almost socially unacceptable to say socially acceptable anymore, but if you had friends and families and divorce court to go through and your reputation in the community, and, you know, it tended to keep marriages together, which meant that both parents were around for the children. You know, if you just are shacking up together, and it's so easy to turn and walk away, and society places no pejorative onus on it, you know, what happens? I mean, people just go in and out of relationships very, very rapidly, having kids, not sticking around to raise the kids, so you get the paternity calendar going off the hook. And the other one that is going off the hook is the domestic abuse calendar, because again, if you may be sick and tired of your spouse, but if you're, you know, married and, you know, the neighbors can hear you and everybody knows what kind of an upstanding member of society you are, you know, you theoretically don't want to smack your spouse and get arrested for domestic violence. But if you're young kids who have, you know, not really all, got all that much at stake anyway and not all that mature anyway, and your relationship blows and, you know, you can just, you know, you just take a swing at your spouse on the way out, you know, next thing you know, you've got the criminal courts getting involved. So it really is a very interesting period in society, what the ripple effect of all this is going to be.
I was just going to use that term, ripple effect, because it is indeed a ripple effect. And it's hard on the children not to have the stability and to have all this. I mean, children are barometers of the relationship anyway, but to have all this frightening, yelling, screaming, perhaps hitting going on, it's hard enough to be a parent, but then to have this sort of home environment is really, it's so sad, really, because we know that happy adults make for happy children. And I read a statistic recently that in depressive marriages or cohabitations, that it's grim for both the adults and the children. And children with depressed parents are, on average, less socially competent, have a lower self-esteem, are more likely to have behavioral and academic problems, and even lower IQs. Can you believe it?
And I can believe it. I mean, in fact, it'd be hard not to believe it.
Yes.
You know, if you got mom and dad both sitting around teaching kids to read at an early age and getting them helicopter parenting them in and out of all their various piano classes and all the different things that parents, that serious intact parents do nowadays. Maybe they do a little too much of it. I mean, there's that argument too. But I mean, there's no question but what you get. You know, the seriously involved parents, where they're together and their whole focus is on their kids, are going to raise a different breed of child than are the half of the kids that are growing up, probably more than half of the kids growing up in America nowadays, with only one parent at various times in their life, with only one parent in the household. So you get a situation where basically there's almost a bifurcation now between, you know, the upper elements of society, the well-educated, the highly employed, the wealthy people. They're still getting married, and they're not getting divorced with near the regularity as are the lower economic echelons of society, which don't have the glue to hold it together. They haven't got some of the communication skills. They haven't got the education level, and they're just going in and out of relationships, and they're having kids along the way, and then the kids are sort of, getting left by the wayside. You don't have a surgeon's general warning that, like we did with smoking, that says, hey, you know, this new wave of cohabitation and one parent households and everybody doing whatever they damn well please, without any of societal constraints being in place anymore. How that's going to affect the next generations of kids is hard to project. And we haven't got any early warning system for what it's going to do, but it's bound to be a disrupting influence on society in general.
Absolutely.
I don't know whether all these kids are going to run off and join ISIS or go play video games till they drop or do whatever they're not going to get the social skills. They're not going to get the education. They're not going to get a lot of the breeding and direction that kids used to get in society.
And there's lots more ADD, ADHD being diagnosed all the time. And we think that one reason is that parents are parking their kids in front of the television or in front of their video games. And so they don't have the focus that's necessary. I'm so proud of my daughter and her family, and Brad knows Katie, and they're living in France for a year. But those two little boys, 3 and 5 years old, they're reading books, and they have very limited exposure to television. And now that they're in France, probably zero. I'll report back after we visit them and over Christmas. But yeah, it's so easy to just park your children and have the television or the video games be the babysitter, and it does very little for their focus or for their real learning.
Well, here's a statistic that is, you know, that's coming out of my book. More than 5 million unmarried couples now cohabit in the U.S., nearly eight times the number in 1970. They've been dubbed committed unmarrieds, or CUs. I mean, they've had to come up with a new handle for this social grouping. And a record-breaking 40% of the babies born in 2007 had unmarried parents. That's up 25% just since 2002. So within 5 years, you've got a 25% increase in the number of babies born to unmarried parents. So, you know, the argument could be made, and certainly, I mean, you're not going to reverse this trend. You know, no matter how much we old folks prattle on about how life used to be better and society was tighter in a certain era, it ain't going to change the fact that these young kids are going to behave however they want to behave. And so it's really a question of society adjusting to them, not us trying to rein them in. You know, some of your readers may or may not be old enough to remember when Dan Quayle, who was first President Bush's vice president, he was rattling on about Murphy Brown. Candace Bergen was the first single mom to appear on television. Do you remember that show? And she was, trying to get along as a single mom, and Dan Quayle was saying, oh, this is a horrible example for American society. Well, it's what American society has turned into now. So we just got to roll with it, but it is—it's going to make for some major social changes.
Right after he did that, Candace Bergen, who played Murphy Brown, was on the cover of Time magazine. It really, talk about ripple effects. It really had. Well, the show became even more popular, of course, because it was well written. But Dan Brown, Dan Quayle. What it seems so long ago now, and it was long ago, but sort of such really odd ideas, and now it's so commonplace.
Yeah, well, that's what the fifth edition of Divorce with Decency is all about. It wasn't more than about 20 years ago that states were passing legislation to revise their own constitutions to prohibit same-sex marriage. They were redefining marriage as between one man and one woman. Hawaii passed a constitutional amendment doing that. And, you know, a lot of states did. And 20 years later, gay marriage is like a given. In fact, it's politically incorrect to talk about it derisively at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things are going to change. And you know, the social trends of people staying single or getting remarried and getting married at later in life. I mean, you know, when we were growing up, gals got married at 22 and guys got married at 24, and now that's, 28 and 30, and then they're getting divorced by 33 and 35, the 33 being the women. It's a very rapidly changing environment. And what's happening now is that due to the economic recession, kids are not stable enough to really think that they can, get down on their knee and propose to their bride and start a family and buy a house with a white picket fence. I mean, you know, all that's totally off the charts. Mm-hmm. In fact, starting with, getting down on one knee and proposing to your bride. I mean, nowadays, you'd probably get a text from your husband saying, hey, you feel like getting married? Let me know, So the whole courtship rituals are done. The whole the age appropriate behavior has changed. It's hard to ask somebody to marry you when you're still living in your parents' basement. So
absolutely,
so marriage rates drops, but people are going to still keep having sex. So these kids are going to keep getting popped out, and that's where the rubber is going to meet the road.
Of course, you ask a question even for people that are getting legally married. You ask a question on your page 278 in the fourth edition. Does being married really make you happier? And you report that you may live longer, because of course we all know that social isolation is such a difficult thing. It often makes people depressed and anxious. And then you quote that those who had never been married were 58% more likely to die a premature death. That's the never married penalty.
Yeah, well, especially for the perennial bachelor types. I mean, that's, you know, women seem to get along far better without the institution of marriage or having been through it but opting not to go back into it in the form of remarriage. Guy, you know, guys turn around after a divorce and get remarried within a couple of years. You know, women either don't remarry at all or wait a substantially longer period of time. Women are far better off. They've got their own social groupings. They've got, you know, they've got a whole different support system than men are. Men without women tend to have problems. They have weight problems. They have depression problems, health problems. I mean, you know, just having somebody nag them about quitting smoking probably is useful to have somebody in the house telling you to quit eating so much, you know, dessert or to quit smoking or to get more exercise. You know, guys can circle the drain pretty fast emotionally if they don't have a woman in their lives. So that's been pretty well documented that at least in the past, you know, getting married was better for your physical health. It's definitely better for your financial health. I mean, there's experts have estimated that it's worth about $100,000 a year to be married. You make an extra $100,000 a year being married than not, and keeping it. And certainly if you want to have kids, as we discussed, you know, it certainly makes sense to be married and try and stay married. I mean, there's no question but what married couples amass more wealth and are basically, you know, far better off in society, maybe as much as two times as much personal wealth as the unmarrieds. But what's happening now is that the unmarried contingent has got so many more options than anybody ever used to have that it really, the idea of staying single indefinitely is viable now in a way that it didn't used to be.
Yes, and so what other aftershocks have you uncovered? Well, you talk about aftershocks for marriage, but what about for these unmarried people that are cohabiting?
Well, it's an interesting, I don't like to refer to relationships as a game, but the game has changed in relationships. I mean, mm-hmm. part of what used to be a driver for marriage and any serious getting into any serious relationship was, you know, frankly, the fear that if you let this one get away, you might never find anybody as wonderful as him or her. And, you know, shucks, you know, I live in a small town, and I think I've exhausted all the talent pool in this town, and I may as well marry Mitzi because, you know, that's the best deal on the horizon. And, you know, I think probably a lot of people, you know, went into marriages based on the limited exposure they'd had to a limited amount of dating or romance or whatever, and this was the best that they'd seen so far. And they got married and had kids the way they were supposed to in the good old days. Well, that whole equation has totally changed.
Totally.
Now, the opportunity cost of giving up on any one relationship is negligible. You just get back on Tinder or Match.com and find another one as fast as your little fingers can type. So, you know, a lot of the concern of, oh my God, I'll be alone the rest of my life if I don't marry Mitzi is out the window. Now you know damn well you can have another date next week or, you know, this afternoon if you just swipe right, or I forget which way you're supposed to swipe on Tinder, but, you know, if you swipe the right way on Tinder, bang, up comes your new relationship. So the impact of the internet and this modern hyper-communication situation that we're in, you know, has probably changed the equation for people that might have otherwise been lonely singles. Now they're maybe not so lonely singles. So, you know, you've got to weigh a whole different set of options that, you know, didn't even exist before.
You quote that Match.com appears to be the most successful online dating website with over 20 million members. I bet it's, since your book was published, this fourth edition in 2012, I bet it's even more now.
Oh, way more, I'm sure.
Yes, and
the only one of these dating sites that probably has fewer members is Ashley Madison at this point.
Having gotten hacked, wasn't that a scandal?
Well, it's already caused a boon in my divorce business. We've had a few couples come in and say that the reason they're getting divorced is because they found their spouse was on Ashley Madison, and they're not impressed.
I was seeing one couple and then seeing them individually, which I often do. And she confessed right after the Ashley Madison that she said it was easy to do. She typed in his name. She wanted to see if he was on it. And fortunately, he was not. But, and they're a very strong Christian couple. But it would have been the end for them if he had been on it. And so, yeah, this is Ashley Madison. It seemed like for the listeners, oh, everybody knows about Ashley Madison. For people wanting to be married and then have an affair. And,
but you talk, I mean, that's a classic way of phrasing it right there. I mean, when you talk about this plethora of new mating options, I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's amazing enough that you've got all these dating sites for single people to go out and look for, you know, whatever they're looking for. And there seems to be a certain amount of evidence building that what was once viewed like Match.com as a place to find your soulmate and, you know, and your real, as you know, maybe lead to marriage and have a real relationship. You know, some of these things are turning into more like hookup sites where it's just, you know, it's I think maybe the wahinis are, for your listeners nationwide, that's Hawaiian for women. Maybe the women are still a little more thinking of them as serious relationship sites, but I think a lot of the men are turning them into, you know, sex on demand, which is, you know, again, changing a lot of the equation that's going on. But you never had any of those options before. I mean, it really is technology dictating sociology.
That's such a way to put it, that kind of flexibility. Technology dictating sociology.
Kind of.
Yep. So that's going to be one of the real emphases in the year fifth edition.
Yes, that's probably going to be. I mean, I've got probably 100 new pages going into this crazy book, but mm-hmm. that'll be one of the main topics for sure.
Well, your book has made a big difference. Again, listeners, it's Divorce with Decency, and my guest is Bradley Coates, Coates, and I'll put it when I do the write-up. I'll put that all down. And, it's helped a lot of people. It's not, and I've referred your book to many of my clients who are headed in that direction, and they find it very useful because, as the cover says, it's a survivor's guide to the legal, emotional, economic, and social issues. But unlike some divorce books, it's the emotional and social issues too. You talk. I remember reading this book, and let's see if I can find where you quote it. It was Mel Kranzler's book, The Creative Divorce. And I remember reading that in the 70s, and it really helped me do divorce mediation. And what he says, I still remember it. I guess it must be still published. I doubt if the author is still around, but do you know if it's still published, Creative Divorce?
I believe it is. And I don't know whether he's still alive or not, but he could, Mel Kranzler, could well be. Because, you know, you're going to need, a lot of relationships, whether they're marriage relationships that are breaking up now or whether it's just, personal individual relationships, you're going to need to have these things. There's going to be an increase in the pace with which people go in and out of relationships. Whether mm-hmm. they're going in and out of marriages or not, I don't know. I can't make a prediction on that necessarily. Mm-hmm. Well, I can. I think probably the divorce rate will uptick too. But what's going to happen is you're just going to have this rapid recycling of relationships, constantly, because people are going to go in and out of more transitory relationships then now that they can. you're going to be able to go back and look up your old girlfriend from high school and say, hey, you know, I remember Betsy used to be really the love of my life. I wonder what she's up to. And then she's going to be on Facebook or Ashley Madison or somewhere. And the next thing you know, you're taking another shot at Betsy. So things are just going to start to roll very, very rapidly through society. But without the institution of marriage to kind of be a bedrock for it, I think it could get potentially wilder. I mean, we don't really talk about domestic abuse that much on your show, but that's gotten way, way out of hand. I mean, like I say, there's almost no rationing device. There's nothing to get people to rein in their behavior anymore. Just people act however they damn well please, and it's it's really kind of a weird tendency to see society get that much more fluid. The other aspect of the domestic abuse is that it's become more of a problem. It's become a more well-publicized problem, you know, when there's legitimate domestic abuse, and it's also become more of a common trick to try and gain custody in custody cases, because there's a trend towards joint custody, you know, sort of nationwide now, especially in the progressive states. They want to try, and on the one hand, the studies have shown that it's better for kids coming out of divorce to have maximum exposure to both parents, so they kind of are looking to try and push for joint custody, the courts are. Mm-hmm. But the one way around that is, you know, if you can allege domestic abuse, then you do get sole custody. So it is, you know, between the legitimate claims for domestic abuse and the you know, the dubious ones, there's the domestic abuse calendar is just, you know, racing upward too. So it's, you know, that's what I see as a divorce lawyer as far as the quantitative number of cases going through family court. It's divorce down, paternity up, and domestic abuse up.
That is so sad. I did not know that domestic abuse, well, you're seeing this in Hawaii, but I imagine it's true throughout the states, to say nothing of the world. And of course, a lot of domestic abuse is fueled by alcohol.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No question.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yes.
A lot of society's problems are fueled by alcohol.
Of course.
So it's, but you know, like I say, it's almost kind of unleashing of the dogs. I mean, if you think about it, if you are in a marriage situation and you're going, God, you know, I've really about had it with this broad, and I really would like to be out of it, and you know, if she really gives me any more guff, I'd really like to just smack her. And then the other half of your brain's going, yeah, but if I get divorced, I'm going to lose half of everything I've got, and then I'm going to lose, you know, I'll be paying alimony for X number of years. And, you know, it's kind of like I say, it's a rationing device on otherwise unacceptable behavior. It kind mm-hmm. of, you know, you kind of rein yourself in. But if, you know, but if you're just, you know, shacking up with somebody for a couple of years, and, you know, I don't care whether I ever see her again, and I don't care if she's got a black eye on the way out, and, you know, I really don't even care if I ever see this kid that I had by her again. Holy cow! That's a whole different mindset. So we've loosened the choke collar that people may have felt about the way they needed to behave in a socially acceptable, you know, situation. And now that it's anything goes, anything's going to go. And you know, the kind of refined behavior that we've spent years trying to, decades, centuries trying to perfect in human beings could start to slip rather rapidly.
Yeah. You, something related that you describe on page 275, you write, one problem I have witnessed repeatedly is that many people enter a second marriage before they've had time to truly recover psychologically from the demise of the first. And this could be a cohabiting relationship too. But this is where I used to call this, and I think I borrowed it from Mel Kranzler. This is called the creative divorce, where you really look at your own part of the divorce, pluses and minuses, and your mate's part. And if you don't do that work, you're very likely to make a similar choice the next time around, because you haven't done any personal growth kind of work, and divorce can be some personal growth, can provide.
Well, and should be. I mean, that's why I wrote the book.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
you've got people going through one of the most life-changing events that they experience anywhere along the line. Divorce, whether you know, like it or not, whether you want it or not, you know, it's a time to really change your life, just like, you know, like dealing with an illness or a physical relocation or a job transition. Or I mean, it's one of those periods in your life where, you know, you can either learn from it and make something remotely positive out of it or grow from it, or it can, you know, just really screw you up for the foreseeable future. And it, a lot of it hinges on how these cases get handled. I mean, if you can go see, you know, a therapist like yourself, I mean, you know, God, if you go see somebody, and the inability to be compatible sexually is a huge problem for cause of relationships to blow up, divorces. Maybe they go see you and they get solved that problem. They don't have to get divorced. Maybe even if they got to get divorced, they learn something and it's not a problem in their next relationship. But, you know, if you get lawyers that just want to just turn these things into a total, you know, gut-wrenching battle where everybody just comes out hating everybody, holy cow, then you totally lose the ability to have any growth come out of it. And that's one of the reasons why I run my law firm the way I do, why I work closely with a lot of counselors, and why we take the whole divorce with decency approach. Is you know, you might as well, if you're going to go through this experience anyway, you might as well try and see if there's something useful to come out of it. And I think lawyers are the worst culprits in making it, in precluding that possibility.
Except for you, Brad. And I often quote you. I did earlier today with a client, and I gave you credit for it. Learn and improve, you say. You go along, divorce or even a breakup of a cohabitation kind of thing. Doesn't have to be a failure. This is quoting you. You keep your eyes open and you learn and improve. And you quote clinical psychologist Dr. Robert Kirsch in your book, "Divorce often forces people to grow up, to get over your divorce by confirming the kind of relationship there was in the marriage. You realize there ain't any victims. You recognize your own complicity in the breakup, and then you learn how to carry on a relationship that works. You can't do this intellectually. You learn through experience." Hear, hear, Dr. Kirsch. Good quote, Brad.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I like a lot of what he writes.
Have you ever met him in person?
No, I haven't met him in person. But I have read a bunch of his stuff, and I think he's a real interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
One guy I have met in person is Dr. John Gray, who we talk about a lot too.
Right.
He's big on the communication skills between couples. I mean, you know, there are some basic things that you can really do to improve the likelihood that whether it's your marriage or just whatever relationship you're in, you can get to where you can improve your enjoyment and communication part of it, but again, it's almost as much as avoiding the obvious pitfalls, because what happens in relationships is people, as they're starting to get sideways, they say a bunch of really stupid stuff to each other. Very, very hurtful, very, you know, I mean, just really, really, you can't put the genie back in the bottle kind of stuff. That really, if you let those kind of fights get out of hand, it ruins. You're never going to get be able to reconcile the marriage, or the relationship. So people just need to learn basic, you know, human communication skills. And you go back to reading some of these or watching Masterpiece Theater or whatever, you know, and, you know, the stiff upper lip Brits or, you know, reading Jane Austen or whatever. I mean, I'm not suggesting we all go back to the 17th or 18th century, but, you know, there was a time where people behaved in a more refined manner.
More civilized.
I mean, the classic, one of the quotes that I'm going to put in my new book is it talks about how men have lost their basic skill set for courtship.
Men used to
have to actually, you know, call up a female, ask her out for a specific date, place, time, you know, event, you know, try and charm her over the phone. You know, if it was the Renaissance, they had to learn to play a lute underneath, you know, Juliet's balcony and compose poetry. At the very least, you know, when I was growing up, you had to buy a corsage and take a girl to the prom. I mean, you know, or, you know, you, now you just, you know, you text, "What's up? me and my buds are going to be down at Joe's Pool Hall. You know, if you and your gang want to come on over, meet us, you know." Okay, great.
Right.
You know,
and
it's really
more group dating.
It's a whole different style of communication.
Yes, it is. I recently saw a female client and you know, she's a very high-level professional woman, and she spent 2 hours a day texting a man in a different state. 2 hours a day back and forth. And they never, and she's married, so that this is, and living here, but this is, so this is maybe an affair. But no talking on the phone, just texting. 2 hours a day. And these are grown up people.
We're rewiring the human brain.
I'm afraid
that's
happening. True.
I mean, you know, we're losing. You're going to lose verbal communication skills. Your thumbs are going to get faster. Your tongue's going to get slower. And you know, it's going to be a question of trying to, you know, rework the way this goes. I mean, another theory that I sort of stumbled upon when I was writing this new book. Or the fifth edition of the old book, whatever you want to call it. You know, think for a second about how all the great religions of the world emphasize the transcending of the self. I mean, with mm-hmm. Buddhism, you know, with Confucianism, you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to submit to your parents and your society. With Buddhism, you're supposed to get beyond the self, you know, through fasting and chanting. And, you know, even the Christian religions, it's all, you know, do more for the poor and less for yourself. I mean, all the great religions have talked about de-emphasizing self-centered behavior. And
yes.
If you look at what the new vogue is with, you know, taking selfies or, you know, how many likes you get on Facebook, it's the exact opposite. It's all about self-oriented, self-indulgent behavior. When we've spent centuries trying to say that the appropriate way to behave in a religious and social context is to transcend your own self and think of others. Now we've got a whole society that's become voyeurs and exhibitionists, and it's all about me. It's, you know, it's me all the way through, right down to what I'm eating for dinner. I mean, it's just, to me, it's almost unbelievable, and I must sound like a total old fogey to your youthful audience.
Well, perhaps to some, but of course you don't to me at all. And the word that you left out in the description of this recent behavior is narcissism. These become very self-absorbed, narcissistic people, and one of the features of narcissism is a lack of compassion or empathy. So that's another thing, right? You're saying to get out of oneself, to transcend oneself, there isn't very much practice in doing that. So the true narcissistic personality, and by the way, they're very difficult clients to work with. You must have had some experience with...
Yeah, there are a lot of fun in divorce cases, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Yeah, so it's... And you know, part of it is we want so much. You quote Erica Jong, and I've read most of her books. I like her. And so this is on your page 280. We want intimacy and yet autonomy, security and stimulation, reassurance and yet novelty, coziness but with thrills. And then, end quote, and that's a tough order to fill. You know, we kind of want it all. We want to be intimate and close, and yet we want to be self-sufficient. We want to feel safe, and yet we want to feel stimulated, right? And
yeah,
and then
tall order.
It's
very
a tall
order.
Order. And women in particular need to feel safe to be sexually responsive and to have orgasms, because their amygdala, the fear center of the brain, needs to go to sleep and for her to really be seduced and let go with abandon. And
well, you know, you would know more about this than I do, but I came across some interesting seeming studies that seem to indicate that women were more likely to actually achieve orgasm in a committed relationship than they are in a hookup kind of a context. And I would imagine that really is true.
Yes, because we know our partner in a committed relationship. We know our partner better emotionally. And one of the things that's really important is for people in a relationship to close that distance that creates emotional distance. And that's what, you know, we're from the time we grow up, I mean, growing up, we need to be feeling safe and secure, and our mothers and fathers need to hold us and love us, and then we're more likely to have secure attachment versus anxious or avoidant attachment. I promised you I'd bring in a little bit of attachment stuff today, but yeah.
Why don't you explain that? Why don't you explain the attachment theory for your audiences? I think that's important.
Yeah, I will. So you can have an attachment style that the best is secure attachment, and usually these people, and I got lucky. I came out of secure attachment. I think you did too, Brad. So secure attachment, they're usually reliable, relationship-oriented. They do a good job at communicating what they want as well as responding to their partner's needs. And with securely attached people, when disagreements crop up, they tend to stay calm and they're ready to talk things out. And most importantly, they're comfortable with intimacy. And so then you have, and this goes back to the first important caregiving relationship, which is usually mother. And so from the time we're toddlers. So if we have an anxious mother who maybe is a helicopter mother too, she often will instill some of that anxiety into the kid. So as an adult, you have people who have anxious attachment style. It's interesting because they crave intimacy and closeness, and they love being coupled, but they consider relationships fragile, and they're sensitive to even minor shifts in the partner's mood. And they don't like conflict, so they don't want to necessarily rock the boat, but they want to make their partners jealous, so they might flirt openly. A lot of demand withdrawal kind of stuff going on in anxious. And then avoidant people, deep down, a lot of avoidants crave intimacy, but they often think that the connection will rob them of their prized independence, right?
Yep.
So to protect themselves from potential heartbreak, they repress those feelings, and they often create distance between themselves and their partner. So, for example, avoidants may feel annoyed or even angry if their partner seems needy, and they opt to keep them at arm's length. They can get easily overly annoyed and focused on small stuff. Anyway, that's sort of we can look at a lot of adult relationships through the lens of attachment theory, and what we're, again, the basis is we want to close the emotional distance because people are craving to have emotional closeness. Some of them don't know it. They don't know how to do it, but they're craving it. So that's a little bit about attachment theory. And I don't know if you have time, but you may want to bring in a little bit about attachment theory to your fifth edition, or not.
I got till next week, so.
Yeah, right, and then you're still carrying on with your practice. But there is a website, holdmetight.com, which is run by Dr. Sue Johnson, and her second book was called Hold Me Tight, and that refers to when you're upset and the alarms are going off with the amygdala, the fear center, it's very hard to do, but what you can do, whoever's upset in the relationship, you can hold that person, pat his or her back, and say, it's going to be all right. Because a lot of times these people have trouble self-soothing. So just to calm oneself down. If they have too much anxiety in their family of origin, they may have a lot of trouble calming themselves down. So,
I've read some theories, and I don't want to sound you know sexist on this, but I've read some theories that say that females in particular are you know, almost a little more comfortable if they feel that their spouse is getting upset over stuff. I mean, you know, they don't want a guy who's just a totally laissez-faire, you know, Rock of Gibraltar kind of calm. That they sense that if he doesn't get as upset as they are over stuff, that it means that he doesn't care. And they'd almost rather see him be a little, you know, uneasy sometimes. I don't know whether you think that there's any truth in that or not, but it was kind of interesting.
Well, I think there is, but I suspect that those folks come out of an anxiously attached family where people are anxious a lot of the time. And that's what they come, that seems normal. There's a very scatological expression, but there's a lot of truth to it that, you know, if you come out of a dysfunctional family of origin and you're going for an adult relationship, the room may smell like shit, but you're familiar with the smell. I know.
That's good.
But it's often true. And as is Sigmund Freud's idea, his theory about repetition compulsion. And what that means is that, and usually it's an unconscious thing, but we will marry our struggle so that, or we'll cohabitate, let's say, since one of the themes of this show, with somebody who is very similar to maybe a parent with whom we had some difficulties. And so we marry our struggle, and we've developed a certain skill set. But the idea is to have the ending, have a happier ending. We want our story, our life story, to have a happier ending than what we may have experienced in childhood. So that's repetition compulsion. Doesn't that make sense based on what you've been exposed to?
That's very interesting. I don't know. I hope that going forward in society, people learn some basic skills instead of too much. You know, I mean, I see it sometimes. We've got a big homeless problem here in Hawaii,
yeah.
as we do in the whole country, I guess, and certainly not as bad as it is in for Syrian refugees trying to get across Croatia, I guess.
Oh,
but
that's
You feel like some of these children that are being raised in these conflicted kind of situations are going to come out to be, more hardwired towards aggression themselves. I mean, I see people in I don't think they necessarily even mean it, but a lot of old style Hawaii residents, they yelp at each other, just as almost kind of like a matter of course. A lot of swearing and a lot of this back and forth, and you just wonder if these kids don't grow up thinking that that's the norm, and then the next thing you know, that's how they're carrying on in their relationships. I hate to see it, but it does seem to percolate through society.
I agree, and a lot of these folks then miss that just some basic kindness and compassion can be very soothing for a relationship. Listening, some of these basic skills, and you're right. A lot of people are so kind of upset and all that they just can't somehow bring forth the kindness. In part of your book, you also talk about it probably works better for couples to be more egalitarian. And I was reading that it's sort of biologically the marks of feeling powerless. So egalitarian is, I think most listeners know this, but it's kind of equal give and take. So the lack of power apparently activates the brain's inhibition system. And that is centered in the right frontal cortex. So then that directs attention to threat and punishment and sets in the motion of avoidant behavior. So people aren't going to stick around and communicate with each other and really listen. And then you get entering into this whole thing, resentment and anger. And it can undermine the generosity and goodwill, which each person will do for the other and make the relationship work.
And well, of course, what I see a lot in the context of marital relationships, anyway, that, you know, egalitarian marriages are definitely going to be something that guys in particular are going to have to get used to, or they're not going to be able to hold on to their spouses very long, because the you know, the statistics are compelling about how women are starting to out-earn men. About in about a third of all marriages, the gal out-earns the guy. The you know, more stay-at-home dads, more women getting college degrees, master's degrees, law degrees, medical degrees, all the higher, you know, higher education is being feminized. Women have got a skill set that seems to be better adapted towards going on. You know, they start taking life more seriously at an earlier age. They, you know, they're able to buckle down, and that's what gets people through graduate school, et cetera. So now these advanced degrees are starting to skew. When I was going to law school, probably no more than 10% of the class was female. Now it's over 50. It's 55, headed towards 60%, getting these master's degrees and advanced degrees. So that's going to translate into higher earning power, and the power that men used to have over the power of the purse to, you know, sort of beat their wives into submission, literally or figuratively or financially or whatever, that's going to be gone. And guys who don't adjust to that egalitarian set of values are going to be toast. They're going to have to learn to get along with more empowered spouses. And the fact that the spouses, that the females are now so empowered, is going to give them the power of the purse to leave if they damn well please. And so you know, the days where marriages, you had to stay with him whether you liked it or not, because, you know, he was, you know, bringing home the bacon, that ain't, you know, that ain't going to happen anymore. She's going to have her own stash of bacon, and now we're finding out bacon's not good for you anyway. So you know, it's a different... it's a different world for sure, and probably it's going to be a matriarchy of successful females, and guys having to, I don't think guys are going to be off the radar entirely, but they are going to have to certainly learn to get along with wives that are feeling more empowered. I certainly have had to.
Well, I was just going to say, I know your wife, and she is a very intelligent woman, and she also earns a lot of money.
A lot more than I do, yeah. Yep. So it's like I say, I've had to swallow hard and be somewhat emasculated, but probably better to be emasculated than to be divorced. So, you know, that's just a lot of these trends in society are becoming they're developing very, very rapidly, and it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes. Like I say, I may have to write a divorce with decency number 6 before it's all over.
Wow. You've learned a lot.
That's the fun part of all this. I mean, the divorce laws themselves are not changing all that much, but the society is changing rapidly.
Yes,
and so
it is.
So it's interesting to watch those kind of progressions.
Yes, and we're going to, the Progressive Radio Network wants me to stop in about a couple of minutes before the top of the hour. But it's really, you know, when we talk about more egalitarian relationships, it's really about responsiveness to your partner's emotions and responsiveness to a partner that makes the relationship feel fair. And fairness has one critical element, and that's respect. Maybe that's a good place to leave this.
Good note to end on. Say hello to all your audience for me, Diane, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, it'll happen. Thanks, Brad, so much. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Labirinto di un amaro autore.